You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCRLP, 92.9 FM, Los Gatos, and beyond.
Hey, I'm Alex Kazemi, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show, yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Alex Kazemi. He's the author of New Millennium Boys. Boys with a Z. How you doing, Alex?
Yeah. Hey, man, how's it going? I'm doing well.
Good, good. You know, I got to get I love your dedication, because your dedication made me feel seen. It made me, where was it? It made me, I was like, I feel seen. To anyone in the world who was born a boy, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's time.
Yeah, wait. I mean, I feel it's time too. I feel it's, why do you feel it's time?
Well, I just feel like you can see in our current culture, there's such an underbelly of male rage and you know, a lack of male issues being discussed or seen. And we see that sort of invisibility result in a lot of chaos externally, with men and their misdirected energy, especially young men.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's like, you know, I think as boys, we're supposed to be puppies. We're supposed to be grappling with each other. You know, it's like we have different conflict things, like bouncing in our DNA and testosterone bouncing all around us. This is not like a good or bad thing. This is just nature. And then to like sit there and poo-poo nature just disgusts me to no end, where I'm just like, ugh.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think it's even worse when we try to pretend that nature doesn't exist, and that these tropes and these archetypes that young men fall into don't have a historical root source. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I watched the Woodstock 99 doc, by the way, for the first time.
Yeah. And
have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Did you watch it?
Oh, no, okay. No, I haven't.
It's
seen
a
it.
Netflix series. I avoided watching it because of the 10-year research process. I wanted to just be inside my own head. But definitely.
Oh, right, because you're setting
a lot of the.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, continue.
No, because your setting or your book is like right there. So I get that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And also the way that they were all talking about in a revisionistic way about the history of that era in the monoculture, the MTV monoculture, was that it was a way to like exploit those vulnerabilities in young men to make money.
Huh.
And Woodstock 99 and the tragedies that happened there was a really big example of that.
Yeah. And then at the same time, I mean, if I remember right, the tragedies were more, I mean, the more it was just like dumbass promoters who just did not care. Maybe I did see some of it, because I just remember knowing, it's just like, let's just get an empty airplane lot. And then let's just like throw the, and then the bands were, I may have seen this, because now I'm remembering these things where like the bands were blamed, where that, you know, these bands are like, you know, punk rock bands. They're going to come out and say, you know, like, you know, just tear this place apart, you know, and that's just normality. And then everyone's like,
And the schizophrenic set list, hey, like Sheryl Crow, James Brown, Korn, like,
oh,
what were
my
they
God.
All thinking?
Yeah, exactly. And then the silliness of that time. I think that that's something I would never go to, just because I went to the first like Lollapaloozas and stuff. So that I feel like that was a little more catered to the music that I like actually cared about, which was like Nine Inch Nails, Ice-T going out there and doing his rap, and then he comes out with this full band and does Body Count. And I'm just sitting there going, this is genius. And Rollins Band is there and no one cares. And I'm like, you guys don't even know what this is. And I think that was kind of the end of me ever going to a festival again, was like the first Lollapalooza. Cause it was just like so joyous.
That's a peak.
Yeah, but so disappointing, because the whole audience was like, who are these weird people? And I was like, what?
What but, album was Nine Inch Nails promoting at that time?
It was their second. I think it was their second album, which was, what was that? Downward Spiral?
Downward Spiral.
I saw them in their first album tour at a small club when they were doing Pretty Hate Machine. And
that's cool.
Dude, that it yeah, really was. Insane. Yeah. And it was one of those nights, and I was just young and I was drunk and we were underage. Me and this girl were like, I worked at a college radio station, and one of the older dudes at the college radio station gave her a bottle of vodka, and me and her were like in the parking lot just drinking as much as we could so we could just have a buzz through the whole show. Yeah. And then I ended up like with I ended up talking to this happened. I totally blacked out for a while. and I was working at a restaurant like the next day, and this girl comes up to me, and it's I used to introduce myself as Anthony at the time. She's like, Anthony, and I was like, yeah. And she was just like really cute girl with a nose ring. I mean, this is like 1990. There's no girls with nose rings then, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so she scared the crap out of me. And she's like, you don't remember me, do you? And I'm like, no. And she's like, you like talked to me for like 20 minutes last night, and you kind of scared me.
Perfect. That's so funny.
And then we ended up together. We dated for a while.
That's a love story.
Yeah, I know.
Perfect rock love story. Well, yeah. Why do you think our current culture lacks so much rock music and rock aesthetics? Like, why? Like, it's kind of confusing to me because it seems like we would have an underlying rage for wanting that type of external release through rock music and rock culture. But I don't, like, where is that? It's not here anymore.
Yeah, so here's my theory on that is that because at that time, and even before that time, these bands were not expecting to get big. There was no big happening because there was no radio station that would play this music.
Yeah.
So this was just like, let's get together and do something that we care about. And that was kind of the punk rock vibe. And then, you know, then things start to happen. Like, you know, Nirvana gets airplay, but it's just like, you know, and Nirvana, you know, I remember when they would come through before the Nevermind album came out, and they weren't known as a band to go see live. It was if Nirvana was playing, it'd be like, oh, cool. We're going to go see Billy Childish and the Headcoats and, you know, and Mudhoney's playing with them. Like, that's a better show for us. And it makes me sad because I passed by seeing Nirvana in small clubs.
I've heard this story many, many times. Yeah.
But at the same time, it just wasn't. But nobody had any clue that major record labels would or anybody would care. There was just, and I think the rage there was different because there may, and maybe I'm romanticizing it a little bit, but there was kind of a purity to it. Whereas now there's, especially with social media, everyone wants to be seen. How many followers do you have? And we used to have like a great little tribalism where, you know, it's just like, if you like funk punk, then you were stupid because you would never go see a thrash show. And if you like thrash, it was
all segregated. Yeah.
Right. But it was kind of like fun because it was like you were choosing your teams, but on such a minor level, you know, I'm team goth or I'm team industrial. What you listen to that? And you're supposed to be snot-nosed kids and have these, you know, brutal opinions as you're finding your identity. And it's just like, if anyone has a brutal opinion now, it's just like, you know, what, you hate goths? She, you know, happens to be Latina, so then you're racist. And it's like, I didn't even know.
No, they make it about like social justice and identity politics as their way of, you know, like gatekeeping certain things,
basically. Right? So then you can't say anything out loud anymore. And then after that point, when you're not saying anything out loud, then you just start to think less. And it's like,
I was watching footage when I was doing research for my book. There was this, like, I was like kids lining up for Marilyn Manson, and there was like one guy who would like literally start fist fights with a kid he thought was a tryhard. You know what I mean? And like that was like his motive to like beat him up was he's like, you're a tryhard, you're a fake fan. So it's really hard to explain that to Gen Z or younger millennials who didn't grow up in that time with the free internet society.
And there, and that's also, there's something, I mean, it's, people are always like, well, that's bad, that's bad. It's just like, no, there was kind of an initiation process. There was also, you know, you go, I mean, I remember going to my first punk shows scared to death and just trying to keep quiet in a corner. And you, and because you don't know. And at the same time, you know what? It's good to be scared to death and quiet in a corner as you feel out what's going on. And
yeah, hierarchy. There's nothing bad about a social hierarchy. And I think that's very much, you know, synonymous with Generation X to a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. And then you start to like, you know, and then I would like start to meet these people who were like in punk bands, and they were just like gods to me. I just assumed if you were in a punk band, you had it all squared away. You weren't living in a cot in a basement in Los Angeles when you were touring to San Francisco. But
yeah,
you know, it's just like, that's so beautiful because they were doing, you know, they were doing.
You think they were gods to you because you had less inundation or of their image, or rather than in this era when, you know, a kid who is a fan of a rock star or a pop star, they constantly see them every second in this vulnerable way on social media.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, I used to go see the Red Hot Chili Peppers like all the time when they still had Hillel in the band. So this was after the second album, and on the third album, I was in San Francisco, so they come up to San Francisco a lot. And where was I going with this? Oh, all I saw was photos of them. So the first time I didn't know who the lead singer was. I just liked their music. And I saw like the guy with the long hair, and I assumed he was the one of the like bass players or guitar players, because Hillel was the tall guy. So he seemed like the guy that was the front man to the me image. Before I even saw them. And then when I went and saw them live, and then the short long haired guy runs out and he's like bouncing all over the place. And I'm all, oh, no way. And it's just, it's just because you've only seen him on a photograph on your album or your cassette. And it's
or in a magazine.
Exactly. And even when I saw like the first time I saw Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, it's like, I only saw Nick Cave on a album cover or on a, you know, magazine that was imported from Europe. I never saw him actually like move across the room. And then I'm like sitting there going, oh my God, this guy's just like, he's got swagger. He's like taking this whole crowd into his arms. Yeah. And so there was no reference point beyond what the record was. And then seeing a person like, you know, go around the stage and sometimes be confrontational or sometimes be, you know, hold back, but just the joy of actually seeing how they walk through life, even though they're on the stage and we've never seen them walk anywhere usually.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, MTV wasn't really on our radar. Cause oh yeah, those people, if they're already there, then we're over here already. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Like MTV kills things. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that was the sort of mentality. And what you're describing, I think it's really hard for younger generations to understand the idea of even a Nick Cave type figure, right? Because there's no pure musical monoculture anymore. There's just a billion different algorithms. So some kid will discover some band on his Spotify Discover Weekly playlist, right? And he'll go to the show and he'll meet all these people who discovered the band in that way. But then other people who found it from the YouTube sidebar or certain things. And then you go up to someone on the street and then nobody knows what this band is. You know, it's just like, it's very strange.
Yeah. And there's pluses and minuses to it. Cause like, I mean, when iPhones started coming out, and then the, you know, idiots in San Francisco were like, 2007 was the year when they started holding up their iPhone at shows. And I'd be like, no, you should be like, you're behind me.
Cause that's what becomes your memory of the show. And then, so it's like, if you're paying money for a ticket to watch a band, to watch them through your screen, and you're thinking about capturing it, why didn't you just watch it on YouTube?
Yeah.
Why did you come? You know?
Yeah. And there was really the YouTube wasn't really a thing yet. And then on the flip side of that, I love watching YouTube videos of bands in other cities. Cause it, so here's my, here's my,
yeah, pro,
here's my proposal. a device section, just 25%. If you're going to pull out your device, it's like the old smoking sections. Here's your device sections. You can do whatever you want over there. And then these people are going to have a real experience.
Well, yeah, that's actually a really great idea, because I think even with, you know, Gen Z, like, they go to shows for it to become a currency for their social media persona, right? They're getting excited of, oh, I get to post this tonight. And I mean, that was the whole thing with the Taylor Swift concert too, the Eras Tour. I think a lot of people wanted to go to that just so that they could promote it on social media, that they were there, or that they could make content to monetize, which is just, it's just so insane thinking of the hyper reality we've accelerated into since the MTV culture.
And that's why novels and books still fill my soul, because I walk around with a book, and, you know, and especially when I see like younger people walking around with books, like the, especially if they're reading classics. When I was in New York, I was at a little cafe and I was reading, you know, I was reading Proust, which I, you know, I just, just because I'm stupid but at the same time, he's genius. But I saw this dude sitting there with a big old copy of War and Peace. Guy had to be about 20. And I just walked up to him. I'm like, dude, how you liking that book? And me and him had like a 40-minute talk. And it's just like, and I'm like, hope for humanity when I see people with just books in their hands. And that's like one of the sexiest things ever.
No, for sure. And I think that I really respect that it's become trendy again for people to read books and for people to be interested in literature, because hopefully it can help people change their attention span, and maybe they can watch longer movies and longer TV shows. Like, maybe that can bleed in to other areas of their lives, even writing novels or novellas or things like that. Because I feel like the current culture doesn't accommodate the kind of focus and attention span that is required for a project like that.
And the current culture just wants you to sell stuff. They just want your eyeballs. Well, you know, it's just like, let's just put these eyeballs in this thing so that we can commodify. And if it's the beauty of developing our minds to just, you know, consume novels is something that, like, it helps us as humans. It helps us as humans to work on our own story and what's our journey in life as we're comparing ourselves to, because our life journey is pretty long. Our life journey is not a TikTok video. So we read a novel that takes us maybe 7 or 8 hours to really dive into. I think there's more juice for the soul, because we do live long lives, and even a novel is kind of going fast through the story of a life, because it's faster than we would ever go through those obstacles.
Exactly. And what you were saying about commerce, like, that's why I love artists like Lydia Lunch. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, people who have that real punk aesthetic to this day, that punk ethos that's about getting the work out there to the right people who want to consume it, and not caring about the entire game of it. Because the whole, especially in this era, like, being a modern novelist or author or whatever, you know, what you're competing against, the information overload, the thousands of books that come out every year, month, you know, it can be very discouraging to even care to even try, you know, with so much noise. But then you start to realize, and you say, you know, the fact that I'm putting this out there is so it finds its audience, that the people resonate with it. But again, like, I'm sure you've heard lots of stories from young authors, or even anyone who's in this era, of like feeling burnout from the marketing and promo process that is just so egregious.
Yeah. No, I got to do another rewrite on this novel I've been working on for 2.5 years. So it's going to put it at 3 years of just pure work. But at the same time, when I was kind of pitching it to my old agent, it's just like, I just feel like a whore for even doing a synopsis. And I don't know who the audience is. It's weirdos. I'm like,
what you even just said, though, like, you know, doing the third rewrite and all that type of stuff. And I know how you feel about that. But what I will say is that, like, in this kind of era, when it goes out there, it's out there. So you want it to be what you want it to be. You know what I mean? It's not that deep anymore. There's no real, I'm falling behind and I'm competing. It's like, look at our current climate, you know? And that way that gives a lot of artists to have more freedom and creativity to be like, oh, okay. Like, actually, I'm in no fucking rush because look at the world right now. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, I actually can just work on the novel that I want to and make the work that I want to. And like, that's the way that I felt about my book. You know, I had a really weird scenario when I was 19. I got a book deal for a viral manuscript. And, you know, I didn't want to put out what I had done because it was like the early sketches of something. You know, if you look up Disney villains, like if you look at the way they looked before they were on screen, you'd be like, what the fuck is that? That's not Ursula. You know what I mean? But it's a process. It's a whole long process. And, you know, I respect people who can churn out a novel every year, every 2 years, and have it be what they want. But that's not everyone's process.
So did that novel come out, or did you put that in a drawer? And
no, that this was this novel. This was the revised, rewritten. Yeah.
So how do you get that kind of attention as a 19-year-old?
I posted it to a website called Tumblr.
Yeah,
I posted it to Tumblr, which was like an artistic social media, early social media thing, and teenagers just really resonated with it. And then it landed me a book deal with MTV, and then Viacom, which my publisher, we kept switching it because of the issues in the book and the way I kept getting censored to the point where conservatives have tried to get the book banned from libraries. And it's been a kind of show in the past year with that. And the whole book ban thing to me is just ridiculous. Like, in general, like the idea that in this era anyone would try to censor information in the internet age, it just makes no sense to me what the motivations of these people are.
I know what the motivation is. People just want power, and when people have low status, this is how they get power. This is how the dumb people get power, is going,
so they go for the jugular.
Yeah. Like, getting banned, I would love to get banned. Like, getting banned is just like, let's do this.
No, it's a rite of passage.
Yeah.
It's a rite of passage.
Henry Miller got banned.
No, it's a huge. Yeah. No, it's a huge honor. It's super great. But you kind of think of like authors, like YA authors like Ellen Hopkins, or people who have discussed teenage sexuality or violence or anything in their works. And then you think of the world that these kids are growing up in, with constant inundation of pornography, violence, all these type of things. Like, my little book, like, you know, literature, which is showing a mirror and analyzing and critiquing, you know, our culture. It's like, you would think that they would be on my side, but they're not. They want to make it into their propaganda, the conservatives.
And those are the same people that are probably right on Pornhub right now looking for, you know, where's the Shitza videos?
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. And I think like, I was sort of under the impression that our literary forefathers who have broken through the game to go through this being censored, and these authors who have gone through the trials, would give a young author like me in 2024 the like freedom to kind of be write anything transgressive or anything that I want to write. But it's not like that. You know, my publisher demanded a content warning from the front
because I noticed that. I was going to ask you that, which I found. I mean, how did you feel about that?
Well, it was a bit of a conversation. I was sort of like, I don't think the book warrants it, because one, there's a gazillion worse pieces of literature out there that, you know, are so much more explicit. But then I thought of it and I was like, you know, it's kind of like a rated R, NC-18, you know, explicit content sticker. And I was like, that's fine. Let's have a middle ground and we'll do it, which worked out. But again, I was not so happy about it in the beginning because I just didn't feel like it made sense. And I think that even the current cultural war annoys me too, because I feel like it's very anti-creativity, anti-art.
Yep.
And I think that we should be using these intellectual debates as we should be creating more, you know, like it's too much. Like I have had a friend recently tell me that a lot of people don't want to start a band anymore. They want to start a podcast, you know, like, cause, and I think that's fine too, right? But it's like, we should also put an emphasis on creativity as well.
Yeah, no, and the thing about a podcast, which a podcast is kind of, is easy to a point. I mean, there's people who don't know how to talk, and they're just like, oh, so here's my podcast, and like, you know, let me give you some information about me.
Well, that's what I mean. Their motivations to start a podcast are more about like commerce driven, you know, narcissism rather than I have something to say and I want to talk to cool people, you know?
Yeah. But, and then the other thing is being in a band is hard and you have to deal with other personalities and you have to like keep showing up at the same time. And it's just, there's something about being in a band where it's just like, we are going to suck for a while and let's just keep doing this. And then all of a sudden, and that's every band, even like every writer, we suck for a while. We get a blank page and we think we're geniuses. And then it's just like, oh, you look back.
Your editor told you to rewrite it 9 times.
Yeah. I look back at my old work, even the stuff that was rewritten. And I'm like, oh my God, it's, you know, and I'm like, I'm glad that never made it on the internet. It's just like,
but it's an honorary process. Like when I think of things like that and that evolution, I get sort of excited because I'm like, well, that really means that you're on the road less traveled, that you're really doing it, you know, that you're really doing it. And that's so much better than sitting there wondering what could have been if you had written that page down, if you had gone for that idea, you know? So I find that, yeah, of course, like, you know, the first few drafts are not going to be good, or sometimes maybe you will strike gold, but that sort of unpredictability of the process, no one is immune to that. It's not like some author has like some like special power to bypass that process. Like this has been all the greats like suffered and wrote about this in their journals, right? Like they all talked about self-doubt and fear. Have you read The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield?
Yes.
That
love
book.
Him. Yeah. No, that book book is required reading for every single artist and writer.
It's just amazing, and he, the way he shares his story and he connects it with like it's so relatable, and I totally could relate to that, you know. Resistance did throw me around for a long time, and it wasn't until the pandemic really where I was really able to coalesce all the research, everything that I had done, and rewrite the book over and over again, and do that like really extreme process with my publisher and my editor to get it to a place where I wanted it to be. But it's just pretty crazy as artists and writers and creative types, like the way that we will justify not working through self-destruction.
Right. I mean, for me to write back in the old days, I needed a couple of shots of Jameson and probably a few beers to even get to the point where I can put my pen to paper. But that was my way of, you know, later realizing that was my way of getting out of my self-censorship because I was scared. So let me booze it up to get out of my self-censorship.
You were trying to diminish and abolish the ego. You were trying to kill off the self so that you could just channel and come from a pure soul driven place.
You said that so much better than me. Thank you.
Because I relate. Because when I was a like teenager and I was feeling the same way, like I would drink or do drugs or things like that to try to write. Or I was like, oh, I'm going to do amphetamines like Kerouac. Or I like played around and then I was like, this isn't really working. Like this isn't really like, you know, like this isn't actually giving the promise of everything. But I think when you're discovering your artistic identity as a young person, or even at any age, you explore or try different methods, you know, and at some point you have to really be at peace with the way that you create and your process. Maybe it's not the same as, I don't know, you know, a huge writer that you love, but your way is still valid.
And I do feel that actually the huge writers that we love tend to have similar processes and tend to have similar self-doubt and
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And even more so because the next book is expected to do way better than the last book, which fortunately I don't have that problem because my first book didn't sell that much at all. So I'm just like, what am I going to do? Less than that? And, well, if I do, okay. And if I don't, then, you know.
Well, yeah. And I think like we always have to like remember like when we look at artists that we love or, you know, authors or filmmakers, it's like, not everyone strikes gold at the debut. You know, if you look at like your favorite people, like some people don't really break out until their third or fourth, fifth project, you know, but they stuck at it and they kept going and they stayed curious and they stayed creative. And again, in this era, the idea of like breaking out, selling out, all of that is just so, those terms just don't even work anymore because it's not like you go on NPR and then like ABC News, you know what I mean? And like, you know, like you just hit the audience. It's like, it's so much more egregious, like press driven work. But like to like be a household name writer is like a very difficult, like almost impossible task. I don't even think a lot of people even know who like Otessa Moshfegh is, you know, but the people who do, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and if Reese Witherspoon wants to put my next book in the book of the month club, that's fine, but I'm not going to tailor it to her audience.
The thing that gets really scary, right? Yeah. Like when you do start to put your work out and you do get reviewed and you go, oh, that they like that quality about me, but then they hate this quality about me. And then you're like, oh, do I start now to write to appease the critics? Do I write now to basically tell my naysayers, no, I can get you to join me, join my cult, join my writing. And if you have that mentality, I feel like that would be very depressing living that way as an artist.
And I got to tell you that I also have a way where I go, oh yeah, well watch this. And then I'll go even more depraved and more transgressive. But what I find is that also is kind of damaging as well, because I'm answering to that. And
absolutely.
So,
yeah. Yeah, no, you're exactly right. You know, the ooh, watch this thing is kind of the trap, because it's our ego being like, oh, I was injured and now I need to rectify that injury. But in reality, if you're creating from that fun, creative place that you love and that you believe in and that you've created a level of standard of what your work should be and that what you like, and maybe your editor likes it or artists you trust or things like that. And that's very different than, you know, writing for the person who like one starred you on Goodreads. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Oh, it was too much sex. There's too much this. And I'm just like, the next book is just going to be sex from page one to page 275. And then the orgasm is going to happen on 276 and then post-coital cigarette on 277.
Yeah. No, for sure. And I think that it's definitely kind of a strange thing in this era where you can get basically live reactions of people consuming your work, which I just don't think is healthy for any artist. Like, it's just so bizarre to get that much, you know, instant gratification out of that. And I think I really love Cal Newport. Have you read Digital Minimalism by him?
No. I'm writing that
He's
down.
A really great author. And he also just put out a new book. He's a Georgetown computer scientist. He just put out a new book called Slow Productivity that I'm reading right now. And it's basically about how we've all been kind of tricked by the illusions of the matrix, the social media culture that makes us think that we have to go faster and become more urgent with our work. But in history, you know, slow productivity is what creates quality a lot of the time. And that the process in general is not supposed to be this thing where we put a bazillion pressured 50 tasks on ourselves a day. It's like, no, like you produce more when you're more gentle with each task. And maybe it takes longer. And maybe you fall into obscurity, but, you know, it's a happier life for sure.
And that is the key right there, because the process, I think, is the writer's life. Like our outcomes are like, oh yeah, there's the outcome. And then people respond to it. And sometimes it's so good, we get inflated, and you know, we can get up here and sometimes it's bad and we get down here, but we know that we're working on the next thing tomorrow morning because the audience is just seeing that now. But that's kind of like, that's the project that we've already put away. So we're on a new project. So the, so learning the process of ourselves and being okay with that process, you know, it's hard to be okay with the process. Me, my process has been a mess the last 10 years, but I know why it's been a mess. And it's just like, okay.
I really relate to what you just said, that idea of being at war or upset with the way your process looks. Do you write in fragments?
No, I write kind of from the beginning and I do it by the seat of my pants. So I kind of know like what's going on and where I'm going. And sometimes I won't. Sometimes, usually I'll know the character.
Do you take notes though? Like, do you write your notes, like ideas as notes?
On notepads. And then I write all my first drafts on yellow legal pads. I do it the wrong way. And then I type them in at night and then I print them out and then I'll bring them to like a cafe the next day and go, oh, okay, now I start from here. Or when I'm in edit mode, like right now I'm in edit mode, so I'm doing my redlining and restructuring of scenes. So there is a forward momentum, but my problem has been the last two projects, like I was trying to dig deeper and go even darker and let's just get even closer to home. So I was writing about my grandma's suicide and I was just, but I was doing it from the point of view of the love story of my grandpa and my grandma who came from Norway to San Francisco. And like the happy, I was trying to create their happy romance from my point of view, not from what actually happened until it turned bad and she killed herself. And then, there's just a point where you work on that for a year and you're working on a real life stuff where someone in your family killed themselves. And then for me, my brain just goes, you can't work on this anymore. Like this is way too dark to stay in.
Zone. No, for sure. I mean, I think I remember reading like a interview with like a true crime author and he talked about how he had like PTSD from working on his novel research for his book for so long, because you don't realize how emotionally it is damaging you and your perception of life when you are indulging in so much dark themes every day and you're engaging with them and you're just thinking, oh, I'm a writer, this is normal, but not everyone around you is doing that and connecting to that. And I kind of, when I had finished my book and put it out into the world, I had to kind of realize, I can sort of explore joy again or feeling, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't realize how engaging and empathizing with these deeper issues that young men deal with, how it was affecting my psyche and the way I was seeing the world. And, you know, it's not like you method, right? But you do have to think of like, what is it like to be in the room as that person? What are they seeing? How are they feeling the world? You're taking it on a lot. You're empathizing with these fictional characters and they live with you. And then when you finish the book, they're not really there anymore. They're not really sending you chirps or ideas or anything. So I understand the postpartum phase that authors feel like when it's out in the world, when it's done, because like you said, the process and the purpose of working on something every day is so much of the writer and artist's life.
And then there's also there's a weird grieving period when it's like, you had that on this book?
For sure. There was a grieving period for sure. Cause I was like, oh God, like when I was like, I miss people's birthday parties. I missed, you know, there was a level of selfishness and indulgence that went into my artistry and my process. And there was a grieving of, you know, missing the world building and having it all stop. But I also dreamed for so many years for it to stop. So it was like a bitter sweet process, because you can also go crazy working on something for so long and you can really just keep going and going. And especially like, I completely empathize with Kubrick and why he never finished Napoleon, because it makes sense. Like every time you discover a new piece of research or historical reference, that creates a new idea, that creates a new thing. You could just go in spirals working on period pieces. So yeah, I definitely have more empathy for people who work on period pieces.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, you worked on a period piece because I feel like that's the same, you know, capturing Napoleon's time versus capturing the millennium. I feel like there's, you know, I'm glad you finished this book, because this phrase will probably stress you out. But I feel like there's more pressure on that, because that can be fact checked immediately by people who are there almost, you know.
So for sure. And it's so funny to me when like people try to say that I got certain things wrong, because I had used so much like fact checking, so much like I had gone to like university databases, like message boards, any type of syntax, slang, anything, I had looked up that it had been written on the internet in 1999, in the 90s. I looked up everything. I mean, some critic was like, oh, pop punk wasn't a term back then. No, it was. It was in many magazines. It was used on message boards, things like that, you know. And also remember, this time period is so precious to so many people, right? So to take it on was almost like everyone was kind of waiting to jump on me to say you fucked it up, right?
Yeah. But at the same time, you did the research, and I'm talking about this all the time when I'm talking to my classes, but it came up this last week, because I do a free writing class at the library. So anybody shows up, which is one of my favorite classes to teach, because it's like the weirdest hostile, but yet grateful room. And I have no idea what I'm getting.
Yeah,
so I gotta sit there. Yeah, it's almost like it's like a playground of adults who don't know that they're gonna be playing with each other yet. And I'm like, but one guy asked me about research, and he was saying how he's researching this, he's researching that, and I told him, I was like, sometimes research is blocking you from working on character, because what do we care about? We care about the character going through.
Absolutely, yeah.
Then we can research and kind of go through whatever period or whatever they're in. But what's so much more important is the arc of the character, and also pinging the human condition, which is what every story is. We're seeing a piece of us, even if I saw Napoleon, the movie, which I don't think I'd see it again. I don't know if you saw it, but it was playing at the Vista in Los Angeles, and the Vista is the Quentin Tarantino just bought that theater.
Yeah, I know that.
And I live like right by here, so I was just like, Napoleon was the first 70 millimeter. So I was just like, I'm there, first showing, let's go. And a bunch of us were standing outside, and it was all dudes. We were all excited that the gates were about to open. It was like going to a concert, and it was like going to Lollapalooza in like 91 or whatever. But
yeah,
we're all just film geeks. But where was I going with that? I totally lost where I was going with that. And I don't know if you remember either.
Yeah, no. I get what you mean. Like,
The human condition.
Yeah.
Because I don't know nothing about Napoleon. Like I'm so behind. I never went to college except to do college radio. And I didn't even know that was an option. But when I was a kid, like I don't know anything about Napoleon. And so to go there and kind of see that, while the movie's flawed, there is a human condition there. And then I'm like, oh, wait, we're all in Napoleon's shoes for a little while. And we can sit there and go, oh, that guy, he's just a bad person there when he did that. But at the same time, we all have it in us. We all have that.
Exactly. And I guess what you're saying is that like a good period piece balances the portrait of human nature and the human condition, rather than constant emphasis on details. Whereas like for me, I was trying to inundate the reader with all of the commercialism and capitalism of that time to mirror what it would feel like to be a teenage boy growing up, constantly being advertised to, constantly having images transmitted into your brain by corporations, having them, you know, not in a way control your thoughts, but definitely influence the way you're looking at the world and sexuality and violence and everything. And I think if I think about a teenager today, it's like where they're learning those cues from, like what, like the algorithm, like the For You page on Instagram, their reels, like TikTok, and they're all getting like different customized versions of that. So it almost keeps them in like a weird custom feedback loop for their own evolution, you know?
Yeah. And it's and this is something I've been kind of been thinking about recently, which is the you know, pre-social media, we had our peer group who would pressure us. And our peer group could be like, I worked in tech for a little while. So I worked at like
Oh,
Sun
wow.
Microsystems and I worked at Hewlett Packard. So that's kind of where I was in that this period too.
Oh,
So it was
cool.
yeah, and but there was a pressure there where everyone was buying like their new cars, you know, their $50,000 cars and their houses. And I was kind of like, no, I'm making a lot of money, but I'm not getting into debt. I'm not doing that. So I just go down there with my beat up Honda that was still stick shift. And so I'd be the eyesore in the parking lot. But the rest of the people would be like, why haven't you bought a new car yet? Why don't you have this? And even my manager was just like, I really wish you'd buy it. So they were like, I just having the old car was confusing their status quo. I was kind of challenging their status quo and the decisions they were making to buy and consume. And yeah, I have the money, so now I'm going to consume, consume, consume.
And it's so weird. They didn't have a social media culture to show that off in an Instagram grid or anything like that. They were truly doing it for the daily IRL social performance.
And then so it's kind of like that was still happening in a weird way.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I realized that I had to get out of there because even I enjoyed tech because I like fixing things. I like puzzles,
Yeah.
but I didn't enjoy the people and I didn't enjoy the weirdness of, because these people just wanted money, money, more money, money. I'm gonna work 14 hours a day. So, and I'm just like, what? I want to sit
And
in a
then the
clock.
culture they were consuming started to mirror that back to them. And then you have the hedonism of the early 2000s coming up, right? And bigger, rich, wealthy, luxe lifestyles, the rich and famous, get this, get that. And then that all blows into smoke by, 08, 07. And then the social media culture is birthed, and then everyone tries to get their income from being influencers and performing themselves on the internet.
Which is it's weird because like people try to chase the next thing, and I see people, I still see people do this too, and they're my contemporaries, and I won't name any names, but you can see they're kind of always chasing the next thing, but not getting good at the last thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you're just like going, dude,
Yeah.
you should be somewhere else right now if your heart and soul were into it. And that was the thing about writing. And I came to it at, I came to writing later. Like when I was like 29 was when I realized, oh man, I got to do this like for I got to do this for
Oh, wow,
life.
during your Saturn return.
Yes, I found that out recently because I just started getting into astrology about 3 or 4 years ago and I had my chart read and they're kind of like they were just like, it's so strange because you're lined up to do something creative and there was like writing and there's also teaching and there's a, like a mentoring energy
Yeah.
to you and it's in your chart. And for
Yeah.
you to find it and not know anything about astrology and to just get there, it show they're my two
It was your
different people.
intuition. Your higher self was guiding you towards it without even the data or the mathematics.
Yeah, and it just kind of blew my mind, but it was the thing that nobody could ever take away from me. No one can take a pen away from me. No one can take a piece of paper away from me because I could still write. And that's like and hell or high water, and, you know, if it's a bestseller, great. If it just hovers under the radar, great. I'm just lucky.
Yeah, a pen is a weapon, a pen is a gun, like writers really we do have a power to use the vessel of a book to say something, to make a commentary on how we perceive the world, how we look at the world and examine it. And I've realized there's a lot of authors whose books never get adapted into films, and they're huge authors. I've realized like there's so many huge authors whose books have never really become films and stuff like that. So, there's that pipeline of when you do put out a book, then someone tries to sell their film rights and they get their book bought by a production company. And then, like you said, they start to worry about the follow-up and all that type of stuff. But these are all really external produced pressures of society. Like you can choose to buy into that Kool-Aid. And the way that I kind of thought about it, like because I've gotten really bad reviews and really good reviews, I'm like, oh, like this has actually given me the freedom to like not really give a fuck anymore, about either of those things. And so it's like if I kind of just believe in how my craft is going to evolve and how I want to put my work out into the world, then, you know, that then following that intuition and listening to myself is much more stronger than being fake for the public.
Yeah. And the idea of film and all that adaptation. I mean, that stuff's just like, that's like next level improbable odds. Like it's improbable that someone gets published. And then to actually get, you know, hundreds of people employed on a film shoot that gets to post-production is just, that's even crazier. You know, it's
And I think with like enough like people who really want to go, like I believe in dreaming big and magic and manifestation and Kabbalah and spirituality and all these type of things. And I feel like if that is meant for someone, then it'll come to them. But I think that if you put your value and your all your intention, all your desire towards those things instead of loving the process, enjoying the process. Because what I've realized is like when you kind of are having a hellish process and you're going through so much turmoil and then it's done and it's out in the world, it's not like you resent the book or you resent the project, but you kind of look back at that and you're like, oh, wait, like I could have had been much chiller and much less anxious about all of these things because it did end up happening in the end.
I love that you bring up astrology and Kabbalah. So what is your spirituality? 'Cause it sounds like you have a very you have a very what do you call it, grounded thought process of life.
Yeah, definitely. For me, I've definitely someone who really believes in like challenging all dogma and consensus and religion and things that induce fear and things that are not productive to creativity and your own relationship with spirituality. But from what I've realized is that I've sort of studied so many mystery school traditions and things like that and realized there are reoccurring themes in all of these spiritualities and that have to kind of be looked at as universal law. So for me, I definitely believe in magic. I definitely believe in the Kabbalah because Kabbalah, all of modern magic with a K is derived from the Kabbalah and Judaic systems. So I've definitely seen the power of the celestial, you know, angels and the cosmos and things like that that are beyond me. And what I really do like about Kabbalah is that it's all about desire, having a desire to receive, but for the sake of sharing, right? In Kabbalah, desire for the self alone is considered klipothic, evil. And if you look at, you know, Anton LaVey's Satanism and things like that, what is all that about? That's all about selfish, you know, indulgence. And I think there's a place for a person to go through that path when they've been oppressed by Christianity and oppressed by certain religion and fear. But you have to get to a moment where you go, oh, okay, like if there are angels and God or things like that, you have to be creating for the sake of giving and sharing.
I like that a lot. Where did you get your knowledge on Kabbalah? Because Kabbalah just sound, like Kabbalah just intimidates me when I try to even research it. I'm just like,
I was like
whoa.
that too for so many years, especially when I was practicing magic in the beginning. But every time I would see Kabbalah, I'd feel this sense of fear and repulsion. And when I would look at the Tree of Life, I'd be like, how am I ever going to understand this diagram? Like, this is just too much. But it kind of came to me at a point where I had been using magic and witchcraft and New Age manifestation, all the type of stuff, and I was receiving things, but my soul was not getting fulfilled. I was not feeling satiated. So as soon as I discovered that I had gone into researching Kabbalah, practical Kabbalah, you know, there's the Kabbalah Center as well, you know, if people are not afraid of it, but you know, things like that. There's a lot of free
Why
knowledge
would
around
people be
it.
afraid of it? Is that a
I don't know, because I think a lot of people are just intimidated, or a lot of people have like because of all the everyone thinks they're going to get indoctrinated into a cult as soon as they discover a spirituality that they identify with, right? That's like the modern fear. Oh my God, I identify with something. I like something. You know, there's even like YouTube spiritual cult guru. You know what I mean? It's just an anxiety that people have. But there is this, there's what's so smart about places like the Kabbalah Center are that they can interpret these over complex issues that are in all of the Kabbalistic magical manuals and make it very simple. Like the Wachowskis were very inspired by Kabbalah and the Kabbalah Center for the Matrix. You know what I mean? So it's like,
wow,
it's like the Matrix is very Kabbalistic in a lot of ways. And this idea that reality is like a multiplex theater that you can choose what you want from. But that in this time period, it's very hard for people to garner that kind of optimism and hope, right? Because if you look at the world, you're like, well, look at the war, look at inflation, look at the social media TikTok vampires. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
how do you gain a sense of like peace and optimism in such a chaotic world, right?
Mm-hmm. And how do you have like a daily practice of something where you gain, where you try to hold on to that peace?
Yeah, I do TM, transcendental mm-hmm. meditation, twice a okay. day. I do yeah. TM and I connect to like daily prayers. I try to do a gratitude ritual in the morning. I try to ground myself. I try to look at, you know, my horoscope, like, mm-hmm. you know, for my rising sign, because I can find a lot of synchronicities for the day through that.
Yeah.
You're an astrologer I trust, things like that. I definitely do believe in the power of repetition around the daily ritual. And I'm sure you've read lots of books that have, like, you know, about writers who have their daily routines mm-hmm. and rituals. I have a lot of fun reading those type of books because it's just cool to see people who are into that. And yeah, definitely. What about you?
It's interesting because it like the prayers thing. I grew up Jehovah's Witness, so I so like oh talking about being talking about yeah talking about being being like resentful and like, you know, with the Anton LaVey stuff and doing the yeah. pushback. And then after a while, it's just like, yeah, get over that part of it because we are, it's the, you know, I think a lot of the problem is with, some of these things, like even in the Jehovah's Witnesses or, you know, crazy religions, there's truth in there. There's the element of the ancients yep. and the truth. And then yeah, it's distorted. Yeah, yeah. And it's distorted. And then that's when, that's why I'm just like, you know, I'm reading Stephen Forrest astrology books. I listen to astrology podcasts. Yeah. I just got a new book on Hermetic something or other. I can't remember the name. And then I have these books on like Hermes and all these, and you know, as above, so below. And I'm like, all this stuff really like just makes yeah. sense. It makes sense. This earth grounding to a heavenly God makes sense. And it's, so I'm in, so if you're looking at me right now, see only Alex is looking at me, but I'm in the middle of a spiritual existential crisis. And then I listen to you and you seem so grounded and I'm like, help me Lord, for I have sinned.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like definitely acknowledging that there is something greater than ourselves is something that really, it's very difficult for a lot of creative types to do that yeah. because they're, especially when we have such an identification with solipsism and our depression and our neuroses and mental illness and things that we want to like stay tragic and dark in. I think there's a lot of fear around, oh, if I bring in God, if I bring in light, if I bring in ease, I will lose my edge. I will lose my darkness. But as David Lynch always says that like, it's a joy to work with darker themes every day when you are yourself at peace and you're not working from that place of depression. But a lot of people like that intensity that comes from extreme emotion to drive their work. But it doesn't mean that you have to throw that away when you're in recovery or when you're healthy and you're not, you know, so neurotic. Like you can access those things. You just have, you're more of an alchemist. You can wield it more, you know?
Alchemy, dude. That's a new word that I've like embraced over the last 3 or 4 years. It's and led also
into gold. That's what we do as artists, right?
Exactly. And I didn't even realize that. I didn't even realize that even as writers, it's there's actually a magic to it because we have this little silly idea and then it becomes a 300 page book that people are reading. And how magical it is to have just an idea that actually becomes full-fledged form storytelling. And then
it started all as a thought.
Yeah. And it even nudges, it nudges the mythology of humanity, you know, a bit. It's like even the Matrix, that was a thought. Did they know they were going to nudge humanity that hard? They didn't know. They didn't know if Keanu Reeves was the right person to cast, because Keanu Reeves at that time, he was a little bit still of a joke. So and it's really interesting when and it's just because he was always cast kind of in the wrong parts, and then they cast him in the Matrix. And I remember when it came out of the theater, I was just like, okay, this will be interesting, because it just seemed kind of cool. And then you're just like, oh, they that was the beautiful synchronicity of putting Keanu Reeves in the exact role that was made for Keanu Reeves. And if anyone else was in that role, that movie may have tanked, and we may not even be talking about it right now.
Yeah, there are destinies that are pre-written for us that we like, we're kind of just like moving and fulfilling that. And then when you tell people that, and then they think of, oh, well, did I choose the abuse as a child? You know, all those type of things. But then if you can take even responsibility for your victimizations, which would be so crazy for people to hear that, and if they've been, you know, really violently abused or things like that. But if you do look at it as kind of a big picture thing where, oh, I was put through this trial to learn XYZ, and then because I learned this, that led me to this, and then it's like this domino effect, and then that is such a more joyous way of looking at life versus, oh, this is just happening to me and I'm a victim. I'm a victim every day. I'm a victim of inflation. I'm a victim of this person not responding to me. I'm a victim of being rejected. And then if you think about, oh, well, maybe rejection is being rerouted in a different direction, you know?
I am so upset. Our time is up. Alex, this has been fantastic. Thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved talking to you, and thank you so much for reading the book and checking it out and having me on here, and it was great.
You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCRLP, 92.9 FM, Los Gatos and beyond.